climate change as an example. There's so much question, I think, in mainstream thinking. How did we get to this place? Well, looking at that from an indigenous perspective, it's very clear. It's this destruction of the natural world. It's this destruction of different peoples. It's this separation from nature and from each other that is so problematic.
Eji pota unye ijaku.
Tokya awija bahe.
Eji te ahe.
Hello, my name is Nicolas Kizikagirre and you're listening to Spatial Dynamics Radio. This is the second part of the conversation with Erin Genia as part of her visit, her cyber visit to Section 8 and Section 17 Spatial Dynamics class from the first year program at RISI. Throughout this conversation, some environmental sounds are going to blend with the conversation. Those have been captured by Section 17 students during the first part of the semester around the Providence River. We have sounds specifically from students Jesse, Shay, Audrey, Yinkai, Dexter, Mehek, Jiju, and Ada. Welcome back.
It's true. Mm-hmm. There is kind of like a spirit of experimentation, you know, that makes us kind of like try things, make mistakes, but try one more time. What if actually I fix this other thing until you start realizing that you're into something in a way?
Right? Mm-hmm.
We've been talking with the students from both sections. I mean, I've been pushing towards not making arbitrary decisions, but not making arbitrary decisions in a way. And I described this a couple of times as, you know, making a decision, and I mean an artistic decision. No, you know, mm-hmm. we're talking about making projects. You know, and so you know, an arbitrary decision as doing something just because it's cool. Right?
Yes, absolutely. I've actually been thinking about that a lot lately because right now I am working as an artist in residence for the city of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in this phase. So it's a year-long project, a civic practice where mm-hmm. our goal is to try to rethink how the city can meet people's needs in a variety of different ways. And so this stage that I'm in right now is the research stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've been thinking a lot about is why me? You know, why? What is it about whatever I bring to this process and in this moment that is important? And so, you know, that with that comes a lot of self-reflection. You know, why do I make these artistic choices? Why is this important to me? And having the ability to kind of think that through
mm-hmm.
Is so helpful. It solidifies, you know, the work that I'm doing, because I know that that's anchored in whatever it is, you know, that I bring. Great. And I think that's something interesting, that every artist brings something different. They bring a different perspective, a different method, a different
experience,
sensibility.
Intergenerational memory. You know, things that unconsciously we bring into our art, things that, you know, like our... you know, in the end, artists are messengers of sometimes something that they're not really aware that they're being messengers of, but important mm-hmm. messengers nevertheless.
Yes.
But I was, you know, when you were saying, I mean, there's another thing that I think is important to consider I've been in a position like that also many times, you know, like what am I doing here, right? Like why, and also why isn't anybody else in my position instead of me, right? Why do I deserve mm-hmm. this position right now, and what am I going to do with it, you know? And mm-hmm. The fact that you are in a position like artist in residence for the city of Boston, or, you know, in many cases, you know, being sponsored by a big institute, etc., is a privilege, right?
Absolutely.
And so with that privilege, and I think this is super important, because you are saying it, with that privilege comes great responsibility. No?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so this kind of like mission, you know, that one has, you know, is it finds a container. No, this content finds a container where to kind of like flourish and be manifested, transmitted, diffused. But I think whenever I am in this position, I always remind myself of the necessity to understand that my position is not a position of taking, but a position of giving,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a position of service in that way, right? And so
yes.
kind of like in adopting and knowing very consciously that you are in that position and nothing else corresponds, mm-hmm. Everything will be okay in a way, because you're going to give 100%, and you know, it doesn't matter if things are not happening, it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is that you're giving, you know? And actually, when that happens, everything ends up being okay, of course. You know, everything ends up being amazing in a way, right?
Oh, I really appreciate you saying that, Nicolas. Mm-hmm. It actually is helpful to me at this stage. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's so much potential in that moment, you know, in that how can we use whatever privilege or position that we have to sort of bring a critical perspective, you know? And I guess for me, that is one that is, you know, as I mentioned before, bringing mm-hmm. forth this Dakota philosophy that has been not so present, you know, because of this terrible history.
Mm-hmm.
So what is, you know, what is the responsibility there to do that correctly and to do that with an eye towards justice?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so I agree.
Yeah, there's a depth, you know, when you say an eye towards justice, I think that there's perhaps, because you were talking before about responsibility, we're saying that maybe responsibility and mission could be kind of like similar, no? But mm-hmm. This mission, this responsibility of passing the techniques, the message, the content, the contain, everything, you know, to your children, for example. Mm-hmm. But there's this other responsibility of kind of like seeking justice in a way,
mm-hmm.
right? Of course, justice can be defined many different ways, right? But
mm-hmm.
but I think that if we take it in a very general kind of like diplomatic way, let's say seeking balance, you know. Mm. But at the same time, it's also
yeah.
recognizing that there is a situation of unbalance right now. No?
Yes, I would say so, definitely. I know I think about that, especially in this moment of pandemic, when here we are staring at these systems that have utterly failed so many people, from the economic systems to healthcare systems to the political systems. And I think that is an unbalance that...
That keeps showing, no? Keeps manifesting mm-hmm. itself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it happens, of course, it happens with indigenous people all around the world, because colonization, colonization has also this very interesting way of presenting itself as an event that happened years ago, and, you know, it's over, now we're different, now it's a different society, etc., instead of showing itself as the current process that is taking place and started years ago, however it continues, it hasn't finished.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I think that is one misconception about colonization that maybe people dismiss it a little bit, because they consider that, oh, this is something that happened in the past. You know, we don't have to think about it. But in reality, the systems that have been put in place stem from those colonial mindsets, those colonial methods, and they continue to inhabit and drive our current institutions. You know, especially, you know, looking at climate change as an example, there's so much question, I think, in mainstream thinking. How did we get to this place? Well, looking at that from an indigenous perspective, it's very clear. It's this destruction of the natural world. It's this destruction of different peoples. It's this separation from nature and from each other that is so problematic. And that's another reason why, you know, with circling back to the sound vessels and talking about this concept of we're all related, you know, Mitakuye Oyasi, we're all related. And when we think that we're not, or we put up, you know, these hierarchies that come from these colonial ways of thinking, it's so damaging.
It seems like colonization, or the moment colonization began, seems like the moment when things became things, right? Like what used to be considered alive started to be considered as something that was dead, you know, object, you know, material. And, you know, instead of a person to person, even if this is with the land, with the soil, with the ceramic, with anything, person to person relation, everything passed to become a person to object relation. And this is very interesting, because then, instead of giving, you know, instead of adopting this position of giving, this position of service, you know, that should be always adopted, especially with all living things around us. And of course, if we consider that everything that is around us is living, then we will be of service to everything, and everything will be of service to us. There is this moment when, instead of giving, colonization adopts a model of taking, extracting, using, abusing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that is exactly, all those words, they have to do with the object, you know, not the subject, right?
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And I think, you know, one of the things that colonization, it has made us forget that we are connected, you know, that it has made us forget very deliberately and systematically.
Of course.
Our original instructions, which are to be stewards of each other and the world and other animals and the plants. And, you know, we, again, going back to this concept of responsibility, that we have that responsibility to do that, and it makes us forget.
Very deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes us forget with very also material tools. I mean, including the one that is nowadays kind of like also everybody talking about, you know, but capitalism, of course, is one of those kind of like, capitalism, neoliberalism, neocolonialism in the end, you know. The tools that in the end are the ones that keep washing the brain in order for us to think that, no, humans are here alone, you know, everything else is below, the entire planet is here to serve, whatever, you know. Like, of course, sometimes those messages are not that explicit, but they're implicit in all the operations, you know, that kind of like... especially extraction.
They're foundational, those concepts that are so destructive.
And so, Erin, how do you differentiate a mine from the quarry of pipestone? I know there is a big difference, right? Even though they could look similar.
Yeah, I think that is a question that the answer to that question shines a light on the differences in the worldviews and differences in how culture is carried out across these very different ways of being. And in some of my sound pieces, the sound vessels, mm-hmm. I've sculpted these pieces to look like mines, to look like open pit mines, and then have used sounds of avalanches and rocks falling and explosions that come out of these pieces to draw attention to sort of the wanton exploitation and destruction of the Earth's body that happens at these mines, like the mines in Chile or the mines in Canada or the mines all across the United States. Mm-hmm. And several of those pieces, the sound vessels, are actually depicting specific mines, as they are in reality.
I see what you're saying. You're bringing the model of a specific mine, and you have modeled that with your hands in the ceramic shape.
Yeah, and looking at mountaintop mining too, the mm-hmm. complete destruction of an entire mountain, and that's so different from the way that the quarriers down at Pipestone work. They go down there with their hand tools, and the pipestone itself is underneath Sioux quartzite, which is an extremely hard rock. Mm-hmm. And so so the quarriers have this relationship with the land, and they have this relationship with the process of, and it's about reverence for that spot, that holy spot. Digging through those many layers to get to deep down underneath. It's a different approach, and you're not allowed to use any kind of power tools or anything like that. You go down there with just your hand tools and that's it.
There are rules.
Mm-hmm.
There are
strict protocols,
including the protocol of not wasting a single.
You don't waste any of it. Even the powder that comes from the stone is always used for something else, like it's used for pigment and other things. Mm-hmm. And you never waste any of it because it's a sacred thing. And you always give thanks, and you always make sure that you're putting things back, and that you're making sure that that ecosystem is able to maintain, and that the quarry will be able to continue to sustain people's mm-hmm. ceremonial needs for many generations to come. Whereas these mines, they don't have any respect for the groundwater, the overburden,
ecosystem. Yeah.
The ecosystem around, and they pollute. Yeah, and the people who live there, like uranium mining and stuff, like those mines are going to be toxic places for generations to come. And what do we do with those? Once we have taken those materials from the Earth's body, what remains? And what have we done with those materials? Have we put those materials into some, electronics products that are just going to end up at the bottom of the sea, like this e-waste stuff, where, are they going to just end up thrown away in a landfill? So yeah, I think it's very different.
There seems to be a clear dialogue with the land, no? We were talking in the beginning when nobody suspected the pandemic was going to become a pandemic and reach the United States. We were talking about the voice of the land. No? We were talking about the voice. And mm-hmm. of course, we were talking about, that's actually the voice referred to, the vocalization, the vocal cords, and all the things that, kind of like constitute a language, specifically perhaps English language, Spanish, etc., Or is there another way to understand what voice means, especially in terms of, for example, the voice of the river, the voice of the land, the voice of nature? What do you say, Erin?
I would say that everything has a spirit. Mm-hmm. Everything has its own spirit that is all connected to one greater spirit. And everything has its own voice in a way. Like when I think about certain features of the land, you know, they have developed this way for millions of years. Mm-hmm. And they have their own, you know, I guess there's really no other way to say it, but they have their own spirit.
Also to understand that the land has a voice, the river has a voice, nature has a voice, it's kind of like a conscious decision to at the same time decide to listen, right? Kind of like listen for that message, you know, and kind of like mm-hmm. it then develop also a sensibility towards that message, right? Towards that message in the sense that, you know, the fact that we're not listening or the fact that we don't hear doesn't mean that it's not there. It's so beautiful to see that how that listening can also become, you know, understanding that the rock in front of us actually has millions of years of forming, no? And mm-hmm. actually it carries an archive, a geological archive of, you know, of you know, year after year, century after century of accumulating, you know, the movement of the wind and, you know, and migrations of all sorts, you know, and all of a sudden we have in front of us something that is way more special than what we think. But yes. But factually, you know, like in, but really, you know, like scientifically, you know.
Yes.
You don't have to look to you know, to, ah, no, the hidden message, or you have to use your imagination, otherwise there's not. No, it's actually sacred because it is, because you have in front of you a million years of time, you mm-hmm. know, in 1 inch of material. What is more mm-hmm. sacred than that? You know, mm-hmm. that is not possible in a way. That is the miracle happening in front of you.
For real. Mm. Yeah. And I almost wonder, you know, when we think about this listening process, mm-hmm. Our bodies, you know, what if this listening process is helping us to remember what we actually already know, what our bodies already know, and that, we're doing a bit of maybe unlearning. We're doing some, because I do feel that, you know, as we were talking about, these colonial systems mm-hmm. have made us think a certain way. They've made us maybe feel that we are disconnected, but we're really not. And so through this learning process, through this listening process, we can unlearn some of that, and we can, you know, realize or remember our connection to these things, which is deeply embedded within our own bodies.
There is one very particular thing about this current colonial system, you know, of kind of like also blinding us, and that is kind of like the itemization of information. You know? And so either information comes as an item or it doesn't exist at all, right? And so, you know, the article, the book, the, mm-hmm. you know, the post, the blog post, the mm-hmm. you know, every piece of information now has a small container that otherwise, if the information doesn't come, you know, in these kind of like containers that are these structures that are generated by the media, by, you know, like these structures mm-hmm. are not naturally emerging from our own souls, you know, the post came from Facebook or whatever, right? And so, you know, if it's not part of that, then we ignore it as if because it doesn't have a structure, then it's probably nothing, noise, right? And so noise, of course, we've been talking in class about this, a sound out of place, right? Sound out of place. So what do? You either ignore it, you shut it off, you know, whatever, it doesn't really matter, right? And so that happens, you know, the sound of the river is noise sometimes, you know, the sound mm-hmm. of this other thing is noise sometimes, but there's nothing noisy about it. It's just that it doesn't come with a tag saying that this is a blog post or this is an article, and it hasn't been translated to one as, you know, like as an item of information, but it is there and it is for us to interact mm-hmm. with it. You know?
Yeah, no, I love it. And I think, you know, those discrete packages that you're talking about of information are transactional.
Exactly. Of course, they are perfect for the monetization of the
yes.
thing.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And we are so, we live by that in our economy. We must live by that, you know, in order to survive. We have to orient ourselves to that way of thinking, into that compartmentalization that is transactional. So another beautiful thing about this listening process and this, you know, is that we, and thinking of what is noise, you know, we can begin to unlearn some of that.
Absolutely. And I think that is the job of the artist, no? To first and foremost, you know, question, you know, the structures that we have around us, you know, because otherwise we're not going to see things differently ever, no? And
exactly.
I mean, the reason why we're seeing things differently actually is because we are already questioning these things. And when I say we, I mean you, I mean all the students in both sections, and I mean myself too. You know, we're looking at things from a perspective that is definitely not the standard perspective or the one that is meant to dominate our thoughts in a way, right?
Yeah, and we, you know, all of us, students, teachers, artists, we have whatever is within us, such a special, unique thing, and is so connected to where we've come from and all of our experiences. And when we bring that to this work, that is such a gift, you know. And again, going back to this concept of responsibility, like, it's almost, as an artist, we have a responsibility to ourselves to use this voice and this privilege to, you know, whatever the privilege that we bring to that moment, mm-hmm. to use that to show, you know, a different way or to show new ways to do things so we can all evolve.
Yeah, exactly. The evolution that started at some point, but it's continuing in a way, right?
Yes.
And we're just kind of like a link in the chain. What happens, and I mean, we've talked about this before, but we've been talking right now about taking versus giving, object versus subject. We're talking about dialogue, the difference between a big mine, a difference between, you know, a Canadian company mining in the middle of the Andes versus the Pipestone quarry. And all these things bring me... there is this polemic topic about cultural appropriation that in a way also makes me, I don't know if you think it's tightly connected to this idea of taking instead of giving, for example, right?
Yes, it absolutely is. And I think it's an issue that always comes up when talking about Native American culture in this country, in the United States, because the tendency and the history and the trajectory of how the settler colonial state and settlers living in the United States have gained their land, gained their economic sustenance, everything has come from this taking of the land and the resources and the lives of Indigenous people. And so that has become encoded into the ways that people relate to Native people in this country. And so, you know, it's important to be critical about that because, like I said earlier, our cultures have been on the brink of disappearing and, you know, just being so severely, just, you know, major setbacks to our ways of life because of these colonial systems. We have a lot of work to do to, come back from this, not only genocide, but also cultural genocide. And so it adds sort of like insult to injury, you know, to have cultural appropriation happen. And it's often shrouded in this guise of cultural sharing. Mm-hmm. But how can there be cultural sharing when one culture is subjugating another. Mm-hmm. And so, so I think, you know, it's tempting for people to say, oh, this is really cool. You know, I'm really interested in this cultural thing. But I think it's so important to think about that dynamic, that power dynamic, and how, what your place in that is.
There seems to be something additional to the colonial system. Not only does it disguise the fact that it's in process and not ended, it also disguises its current process as what you're saying, cultural sharing, or maybe a cultural dialogue. No, I many times feel that the British Empire with the United States has a different relation to what the Spanish has to Peru. But there seems to be always an official, especially from Spain, I guess, kind of like this course of kind of like, you know, we're all together, you know, like we're all Spanish-speaking countries, you know, we have grown together to become, you know, like a large community of Ibero-America, you know, like, and it's constantly trying to push a discourse of cultural dialogue without recognizing the discourse of cultural appropriation or cultural theft altogether. You know?
It's a theft, and then it's a forced assimilation into the dominant culture.
Exactly. You know? There's no choice.
Right. There's no choice there that you have to do this in order to survive. And so, I think we're in a place today where we really need to be thinking about all of these, this legacy, right? This, if we're to move ahead in an equitable way, and if we're to build structures that are, and build technologies that are, going to withstand what is coming in our future, then we have to really grapple with these legacies.
Mm-hmm. There's one other thing that I was thinking, it's not that cultural dialogue is not possible. We've been talking about the colony or the colonizer pushing the idea of cultural dialogue when it's not happening. But cultural dialogue is possible in the sense that alliances and bridges and mechanisms of cooperation and collaboration not only are possible but also necessary. Nobody's asking for cultural isolation and each person does one thing or not the other, right?
That's right. Yes, and cultural sharing is happening, but it must happen within this context, right, of figuring out who benefits and who, who is, again, this power dynamic, how can that be addressed? Mm-hmm. And it must be kind of out in the open, you know, and made sure, you know, when engaging in that process, making sure that your understanding of that context,
understanding that you could be even without noticing in a position of taking instead of giving,
yep.
In a way, Erin, I wanted to ask you about this is a project that we kind of like traveled with together, and so. We were talking about how we went to Venice and we missed the plane left us and we had like but we ended up arriving to Venice and each one with our projects. I had the speaker tower and you were carrying the acoustic teepee. I was carrying the speaker tower disguised inside a bag that looked like there was a drum inside and you were carrying the acoustic teepee inside a snowboard bag.
Oh my gosh, the two of us. What a pair.
What a pair. Stranded in London. This was a complete disaster. But we made it. We even went to the airport to pick up the things that arrived. I don't know how many days later, but
yes.
Tell us about the acoustic teepee.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So Acoustic TB, it's actually still in Venice. Yeah, it's still there. It's at Palazzo Mora because it remained in Venice through the Biennale last year, the Art Biennale, and I have to go get it. It's in storage. But so Acoustic TB is an interesting piece because, you know, we were talking before about this swamp pavilion, right? The swamp, and Venice is a swamp. It's a wetland, and here in Boston, actually, too. I've been thinking a lot about this as well because Boston, the original land of this area, is a swamp, a wetland. So Acoustic Teepee is an expression of another Dakota story that I wanted to bring to the forefront of people's imaginations and thinking right now, because this story of the Waukeon, which are the thunderbirds, and the Onktehi, which is the water serpent, water monster, this story actually describes climate change at a earlier historic stage. And so I thought that it was a very interesting way to talk about what's happening now and to think about, you know, climate change from the lens of a Dakota perspective. So Acoustic Teepee itself was built to house four drums, and they're all of different sizes. And the drums are embedded into the teepee form, which is made of wood. And I made it of wood because I was thinking of like a guitar, or thinking of some kind of like a wooden structure that would vibrate and be able to project the sound of the drums.
Because the teepee has this kind of like, you know, there's a coincidence that the teepee has this conical shape that is also used, or that is also very useful to project sound, you know?
Like... Exactly, yeah. It has the shape of sound, you know, projection. Mm-hmm. And so it's perfect for this form of this cone is perfect for that. Mm-hmm. So what the Acoustic Teepee does is it allows up to four people to stand together around it and to play the drums. And the drums, you know, are, because of the shape of the teepee, mm-hmm. The vibrations from the drums go down into the earth, and they also go up into the sky. And so on the teepee itself, I depicted this story of the thunderbird and water monster to tell this tale of climate change from this perspective, and to sort of... Bring that story into the forefront of the conversation about climate change, particularly in the wetland area of Venice. I also appreciated how Acoustic Teepee was in conversation with your speaker tower too, because they were set up next to each other for a time, and the messages that were emanating from your speaker tower were related to the messages of the drums, you know, and of the story of Acoustic Teepee. So that was a really wonderful connection there.
And I think they still are in dialogue, no? And mm-hmm. they will continue to be, and perhaps they will again, you know, share the same space. But I think that there still is kind of like a cosmic dialogue between these two pieces.
Yes, you know, definitely.
Kind of like a friendship, you know, mm-hmm. Which is very beautiful to think.
of our pieces as friends. I like that.
Erin, what would you say? Okay, so you haven't seen, maybe you've seen some of the profiles of the students from both sections, the 08 and 17400. By the way, the name 17400 comes from, I think it was Leah who said these, but 17400, she proposed a name, and it's the frequency that adults cannot hear, she said.
I love that.
And so it became officially the name of the section like right away. What would you say to 40 students scattered all around the world, trying to make the best of out of this experience, tired of the screens,
yes,
about to finish in 3 weeks the semester and entering, you know, a summer of pandemic, which is a very strange situation, you know? How do we deal with this time as artists? How do we move forward? Where are we? Where are we going, Erin?
Well, I don't know. I don't know to a lot of that. But what I would say is that, you know, having looked at some of the student profiles and some of the student work, there's just some beautiful voices coming from this work that you all are doing together. And I think that during this time of pandemic, it's so disruptive to our normal ways of relating to ourselves, even to each other, to the world itself. But within those times of difficulty are always times of opportunity as well, and you know, we have a chance to think about things in a different way. And When I think of that, you know, I guess I think that there's a chance for our own voices to be strengthened, for us to consider how we exist in this moment, and to think about ourselves even further, you know, to what we can bring, what unique voice, what unique thought, perspective, experience, method we could bring to the work that we're all doing.
What is our mission?
What is our mission?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the other thing is that I've been looking at the news probably too much, but
like everybody.
Oh gosh, it's like so hard to look away from it all. You just want to know more information, but it's also, you know, hard to look at all that information too, because it takes an emotional toll. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at this article about how the world has quieted in this pandemic, like these seismic detectors that you know, are constantly measuring the frequencies and the wavelengths of the sounds and the movements of the earth, mm-hmm, have been recording much more quiet activity.
So moving less, in a way, jumping less as needles, yeah.
Yes, as we are forced to be in these, in our homes, in our, you know, in our rooms, we have an opportunity to be in stillness, which can sometimes feel, you know, isolating and enclosing, but at the same time, what can that bring us? What can that moment of stillness bring us? What can we hear when we're still? And I guess I would just encourage everybody to think about that, you know, in these moments of stillness, what can we hear? What can we perceive that's happening in the world around us, that's happening, you know, within ourselves too? So...
is it really noise? No, like sometimes what can we hear? And we, you know, in our daily everyday lives, you know, in our daily life with a specific rhythm and everything, you know, what we heard many times was noise, right? Mm-hmm. I think that we have this opportunity to listen to that noise, understand, not that this is sound out of place, but what is actually the place of this sound, you know? you know, do not dismiss the sound, the idea. And when I say sound, you know, sound out of place, in the end, noise in the end can also speak of ideas, of people, of vegetation, of many, many other things, you know. And yes. I think that it's important for us to consider that there is no such thing as sound out of place. And if we want to make, or if we want to understand meaning, we also have to find a place for that sound that is currently out of place in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
A place for that idea that is currently out of place, that it's not part of our system of values right now.
Yes, I love that. That's beautiful.
This is coming out of this conversation. Like, I think that it's the one last thing that I think it's important is for us to understand this moment, even though we can be in a position of, you know, sometimes privileged, sometimes not necessarily, we can be suffering, we can be, etc. You know, we can be going through a lot of pain, or we can be going through joy during this pandemic. I think that it's in all the cases important to put ourselves in the position, in the perspective, and in the angle, you know, the viewpoint of others.
Yes.
And I say this for two reasons. The first one is because there's a lot of people that are really suffering. There's people that are not only, and when I say suffering, I mean that are really suffering death, the death of their community members, and at the same time the uncertainty of you know, the near future. And I also say this because the perspective of others is not the perspective of other humans only, but it's also the perspective of, and this brings us back to the beginning, I think, you know, it's not only the perspective of other humans, it's the perspective of the land, the perspective of the river, the perspective of the ducks, the perspective of the trees, you know, and to live through this moment also trying to understand, what are they thinking about this? what is going on according to them? Or in any case, trying to understand that we are a completely, completely connected network. And if there is something in the entire world that can demonstrate how networked we are, it is the coronavirus.
Yes, it is. It is. And I think you're so right about that. It's showing us this undeniable thing that we are so connected, that we are, there's no disconnection. The ways that we have been taught to, and the ways that we have been functioning in our society, you know, they're not reflective of even the way the natural world is. And this is, like I said, you know, it's a terrible time, but it is an opportunity to think about those things. You know, with when as you say, so many people suffering within this hierarchy of, you know, those people who the system has built upon their backs, has been built upon their backs, that we must think of the ways in which and enact ways that will eliminate those that separation between us, so that everybody, you know, can live a good life, all of our relations can live a good life.
Beji pota unge ijaku.
Tokya awi jagahe.
Beji te ahe. Ahu.
Je suis pour ta Tokia Aujada hai. Tejis pota unie, ujaku.